compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Patrick Madrid, as you might have guessed. My number is 888-914-9149. We have lines open right now. People I can see are lining up to get on the air. You could be one of them. Just call me at 888-914-9149. You can also send me a message on Twitter. My address there is at Patrick Madrid. Now, I'm sure you remember a year ago or so. What would that have been? So May of 2020. And maybe even a little bit before that. So let's say like late March. And do you remember when there was stuff that you could get at any given time at any grocery store, and then you went in and then it was gone? And there were like whole long sections of the aisle that were just devoid of any product. Things like Lysol and wipes and hand sanitizer and things like that. Well, how the world has turned. The Wall Street Journal has an article about how retailers a year ago, they couldn't get it in stock fast enough. Do you remember that? And now they can't give it away. So for example, Keith Milligan, he's trying to get hand sanitizer off his hands. Ha ha. He's the controller of the Piggly Wiggly stores in Alabama and Georgia. And they're offering 4-for-1 specials on hand sanitizer after sales nearly halted earlier this year. He's tried selling the disinfectants for half price. He's discounted them at 75% off to no avail. He says nearly every family has 2 or 3 bottles of it. He plans to give them away to shoppers at checkout stations if the latest promotion doesn't make a dent, because he's sitting on a mountain of these hand sanitizer bottles of all different sizes. It's one of those things where you're planning and you assume that you are going to need so much more than you really do. And then when demand doesn't keep up with supply, you've got this huge amount. Consumers rushed to buy hand sanitizers when the pandemic took hold, eager to clean their hands and protect themselves from the new coronavirus. The surging demand resulted in shortages and purchase limits at retailers across the country. I remember being, you know, it's funny, like we all sit around the campfire and tell our stories about, well, what were you doing during the pandemic of 2020? Well, I remember being in the airport at Phoenix, which is a big airport. And there are lots of those little stores, you know, the stores where you could buy gum and newspaper and a bottle of water, those stores. There must be 50 of them in this gigantic airport in Phoenix. And this was right as COVID was hitting and people were just now starting to wear a mask. Just a few people, not too many people, because it hadn't been mandated yet. Because back in those days, the Attorney General and Dr. Fauci and CNN and the rest were telling us, don't wear masks. Masks don't work. Don't be an idiot and buy the masks, because the people who work in the medical community, they need the masks. You remember that when they were telling us that? And now it's like the religion. Anyway, back in those days. So I realized that something's changing because I was watching the news and seeing all the reportage about it. So I thought I would do a little experiment. And I was shocked by what I found. It was this early in the pandemic. I went to one of those little stores in the airport and I asked for, where's the hand sanitizer? They said, oh, we're out. Oh, really? Okay. So I walked another 100 yards to another store. And the same thing. And the same thing after that and after that. I probably stopped in at about 6 stores over the course of the time that I had free to walk around. And all of them were out. And one of the clerks said, you know, they come in batches of like 24 and they're instantly gone. And people are lining up. We've had to limit them. That's what this was like just a year ago. And now they can't get it. They can't get rid of it. So maybe now would be a great time to buy some hand sanitizer. You know, do your stockpile. It reminds me of also the issue of toilet paper. We went through something similar. And remember when you couldn't easily get your hands on a roll of toilet paper because people were hoarding and panic buying and the stores couldn't get enough of it? Well, thankfully, nowadays, that commodity is available on the store shelves. But it might not be a bad idea just to stick another package of those in the closet somewhere just in case, because you never know how these things fluctuate. Now, speaking of fluctuating, we've been hearing all kinds of different claims, predictions, people saying this is what's going to happen or this is what should happen when it comes to things like COVID vaccine, passports, certificates. Well, as you might imagine, the airlines now are having to deal with the black market of fake COVID-19 certificates. Again, from the Wall Street Journal, the documents are often the COVID-19 test results required by many countries on arrival. The International Air Transport Association, they say that they're tracking fake certificates from multiple countries, from France to Brazil, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. Border control authorities and police forces have also reported arresting people who are selling these fake documents in the UK and Spain and other places. The problem is hitting international flights more than domestic ones, which typically don't require certification at the moment. Airlines that are more dependent on cross-border travel, particularly those operating in Europe, are growing increasingly alarmed as they look to the summer when they still hope demand will start to return. They say the proliferation of the fake health certificates is exposing a logistical blind spot as airlines rush to navigate post-pandemic travel standards and retool their systems to ease compliance and spur demand. Airlines say their staff aren't equipped to handle and police all the new health certificates needed and worry the problem will be exacerbated when some countries also start to ask for vaccination certificates. So this is all unfolding. As you and I have known for a long time now, that it would eventually get to this point, and it's getting there. They're fining people when they find these fake certificates. But I don't know how you're going to avoid this. It's like currency. You know, you got some guy in his garage who's cranking out fake currency. Now it's very difficult because the state of the art of making currency in the mint, for example, is so sophisticated that I don't think it's – well, let's put it this way. I don't think it's easy anymore, if it ever was truly easy, to make counterfeit currency. But it's probably getting to the point where it's just about impossible, or so I would hope. But people still do it. And they're doing it with these certificates. So FYI, I have a feeling that the time is not too far off when the when it will no longer be sufficient to have a piece of paper because of this reason. And you will then be required to have an app on your phone, and then the app will have a QR code, and the QR code is scanned, and then that will identify whether or not you've been vaccinated. I think things are heading in that direction. And this is not a commentary one way or the other about vaccines, just how is this going to be handled from a technological standpoint? In other words, what will the governments and the security agencies and the airlines and all of the rest of them, eventually it seems they're likely to settle on some common form that will be the same wherever you go, at least in the United States. We'll see about that. But it seems to me that this is the direction it's heading in. Next up, and by the way, my number, don't be shy, 888-914-9149. 888, by the way, Cyrus is off today. Jim, are you fully stocked up on toilet paper and hand sanitizer? I mean, do you have your you have your doomsday cash?
You know, the funny thing is we're stocked with toilet paper, hand sanitizer, and when I'm at the store, when I'm at Costco, I buy more just because.
Now, is that technically panic buying? Because you're not in a panic, right? So that's not technically panic buying, right?
No, no. It's just kind of being prepared, I guess. I wouldn't call myself a prepper, but, you know, it never hurts to have a little more of toilet paper, water.
Some people might call you a hoarder. If they, I wouldn't do that. I'm a nice guy.
Well, my
but they
wife
might say you're hoarding.
My wife hasn't called me that yet, but I do tend to, you know, stock up when, you know, they got the canned goods on sale and that sort of thing. But
you know, I'm kind of that way myself, actually. So if I'm in the grocery store and I know we already have a couple cans of tuna fish in the pantry, I'll get a couple more cans just to go a little deeper on those things.
That's a great reminder. I forgot to put that on the list.
Yeah, so you're going to hit the grocery store after work today, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good idea. Another thing that people are short on, thanks, Jim. Another thing that people are short on right now is houses. If you're trying to buy a house, you're basically, you're going to have to go into feeding frenzy mode because houses all over the United States, this is actually reflected in other parts of the world as well, but especially here in these United States, if you want to buy a house and a house goes on the market, it will very often be sold after maybe 10 or 12 people bid on it that same day. This is happening everywhere. there are just not enough homes, and the homes that are there are being snapped up so quickly. So the other problem is kind of a two-edged sword here, is that there aren't enough home builders. So you'd think that that would be coming to the rescue, but there are just aren't enough home builders. This is a very good time if you are a general contractor or a subcontractor for that matter. The Commerce Department on Friday of last week, they reported that construction began on 1.74 million homes in March at a seasonably adjusted annual rate. That was a big move up from February's 1.46 million housing starts when winter storms stifled construction. Now, you'd think that 1.74 million new homes would be just a glut, right? And that's just for 1 month. But believe it or not, even with those numbers, they just cannot keep up with the demand. The stepped-up pace, according to Justin Lahart, the stepped-up pace of building reflects a remarkable resurgence in the housing market that the COVID-19 crisis set off as low interest rates and city dwellers flocked to the suburbs, and that substantially boosted demand. There could be some bumps ahead, they say, since rates have been trending a little higher, and some demand was likely pulled forward by families who would have eventually exited the cities in any case. But a combination of a growing economy, more millennials starting families, and changes in where people and businesses can locate as a result of, you know, Zoom. Freddie Mac estimates that at the end of this last year, the country was 3.8 million single-family homes short of what is needed to meet demand. Now, the other part of the problem is that there aren't enough contractors to build homes. So that's another complicating detail. I've seen some situations. It's truly amazing. This is a great time if you want to sell your house. This is the perfect time to do it. You can sell it very quickly. Very quickly. I mean, assuming that it's priced reasonably and it looks okay. But even if it doesn't look okay, it's probably still going to sell very quickly. I've seen some situations where a house goes on the market and people are making offers without even seeing it. They don't even have the time, because so many other people are piling in and giving their bids that they don't have time to even get in to see the house, and they're making an offer on it. Usually it's well above whatever the asking price is. Quick story about selling houses. This is back in the day, and as luck would have it, or God's providence, I guess, this is before this kind of feeding frenzy was in place, long before. This is back in the, what would it have been? It was back in the 90s. And Nancy and I had a house that we had outgrown, and we wanted to sell it, and we couldn't sell it, and we couldn't sell it, and we couldn't sell it, and we just, it just took, everything we did, we couldn't sell the house. It just sat on the market. And this went on for like a year. So we were very discouraged, and we had a friend of Nancy's, who was saying, well, you should bury a statue of St. Joseph. You know, just like, you know, we understand the idea behind it. And we found that realtors even had like St. Joseph statue kits that you could bury in your yard, and you could sell your house quickly, and all kinds of stories of people who had done that. But it just didn't seem right to us. It didn't sit right with us. So we didn't do that. You know, they were saying, well, bury it upside down, bury it in the backyard, and you'll sell your house. So we thought, no, we're not going to do that. So after all this time of trying to sell our house unsuccessfully, we thought, well, we haven't tried a novena yet, so let's try a novena. And let's try a novena to St. Joseph. So we did. And as you may know, a novena is typically it's a prayer that would last every day for 9 days. That's where the term novena comes from. And it's a biblical idea to go and pray for a set number of days or a certain number of hours. So in this case, we thought, well, ask St. Joseph to help us sell our house. He knows what it's like to have to deal with a family and move from place to place. So we'll ask him to help us by asking him to pray to the Lord for this intention. So we did that, and wouldn't you know it, on the last day of the novena, which happened to be, by the way, St. Joseph's feast day, we sold a house. And it came out of the blue. It was an offer that came out of the blue after a long drought of about a year of not even getting any offers. You know, people would come in and take a look, and, okay, they wouldn't offer anything. So on the last day of the novena, which happened to be on the feast day of St. Joseph, we got an offer, we accepted the offer, and we sold a house. Now, I don't know what that means as far as like St. Joseph giving an editorial comment about the fact that we didn't bury his statue, you know, maybe he was giving us a thumbs up, you know, way to go, guys. I'm not sure about that. But that's that was our story. And boy, do I wish back in those days that we had had the kind of market that they've got right now. 888-914-9149. Let's do some phone calls before we take our first break. We'll go over to Don now, listening in Los Angeles. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. I converted to the faith just shy of 10 years ago, and I'm finding some struggle. I still have a lot of Protestantism in me, and I don't know how to reconcile this moving forward. I mean, I'm always going to lean on Jesus just a tad more than I will his mother. I'm always going to lean on the authority of Scripture, individuals who can't use them responsibly. I just want to know your thoughts. Is there room in the Catholic Church for a Protestantized Catholic man like myself who was raised in a traditional Lutheran household?
Yes, there is.
Well, I mean, that's comforting. But what are your thoughts as far as, you know, if you, you know, kind of judging by where I stand, I think the reforms of the Second Vatican Council are the greatest thing. You know, I know there's some members of the SSPX Society who are, you know, gasping it right now, but I think it's beautiful, you know, the idea of where they turn the church, judging from where it's been historically. You know, what are your ideas?
Well, I'll put it this way, Don. I can't relate to what you're going through because I'm a cradle Catholic myself. I was raised Catholic. I've always been Catholic. So I don't have the benefit of seeing it from your perspective, but I can try to imagine. And knowing a lot of converts to the Catholic faith from Protestantism and hearing their stories and struggles and such, I mean, I can imagine that in a way it's like living in a foreign country. You've moved to this foreign country and you know the language and you can get around, but you'd rather continue celebrating maybe some of your own customs or doing things the way you did it back where you came from. I can understand that. That's, I think, a normal human emotion. How long have you been Catholic?
About 8 years.
About how long?
Eight years. And so
8 years.
I've literally
okay.
been, yeah, yeah,
been. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, 8 years is not insignificant. It's not a long time, but it's also not a little bit of time. So my sense is that as long as you seek to be a Catholic sincerely, in other words, that you're, as long as you're making an effort to live your life as a Catholic, as best you understand it, and to seek to do what's right and seek to believe in what is true, and asking the Lord to guide you and being willing to be guided by the church, I think that's in itself what's necessary. Now, if you still have emotional tugs in the other direction or there's certain prayer forms or something that you prefer that don't conflict with the Catholic Church or are not opposed to the Catholic Church, I see no reason why you have to ignore those or jettison those. But I would offer just this one caution, that would be if you find yourself saying the Catholic Church officially teaches this, and I just don't buy that, I don't believe that, then it seems that you would need to, you'd owe it to yourself to do a deeper study so that you could at least come to the conclusion, well, I see why they teach this, and I'm willing to assent to it. I don't get the impression from what you said that you have any problems like that, unless I'm misreading things. But sounds to me like you're doing the best you can and you're sincere about it, which I think is the most important thing, that you're really honestly making an effort to be a Catholic.
No, well, I just wanted to see if, you know, to be better, if, you know, if it's, yeah, well said. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm glad, Don. I have to take a break, but this is a good point to end up on. God knows your heart, and if you're doing the best you can and you are living the faith as well as you can, what more can God ask of you? Thanks a lot, Don. I appreciate it. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app, wherever in the world you may be right now listening to this program. I thank you for that. And by the way, I've got some medical data I'm going to share with you when I come back that has to do with depression. Very interesting. Don't miss this. I'll be right back.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we're back, and thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show, 888-914-9149. As promised, I want to share with you from Medical News Today, a study challenges a link between depression and inflammation. In recent years, a growing body of evidence has suggested that inflammation and depression are intimately linked, but new research challenges this notion, the idea that inflammation may be what drives and characterizes your depression, if you experience that or you know somebody who does, has been gaining more and more ground in recent years. A study published in 2015, for instance, found that clinical depression is linked with 30% more inflammation in the brain. A couple of years later, another study found markers of brain inflammation in people with suicidal ideation, and other researchers have suggested that low-grade inflammation may reduce motivation to perform daily tasks. A lack of coffee in the morning could reduce motivation to perform daily tasks. That's my contribution to medical science. But a new study challenges this popular notion. A team led by Eiko Fried, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, he has applied network analysis to study the links between individual depressive symptoms, inflammatory markers, and covariates. That sounds like interesting reading, doesn't it? Their findings appear in the Journal of Psychological Medicine. The researchers started from the observation that the existing studies tackling the link between depression and inflammation have not yielded unanimous results. This explains, the authors say, why these two results, either the studies have examined different markers of inflammation or specific symptoms of depression and how they may relate to inflammation in differing ways. The database included information from more than 2,300 people, some of whom did not have depression and some of whom had the condition with symptoms ranging from ranging in extremity among this study cohort. Applying network analysis enabled the researchers to study the link between 28 individual symptoms of depression, various lifestyle factors, and inflammatory markers such as a C-reactive protein. There will be a test on Monday, by the way. Interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha. I think I saw that band in the 80s. I think I did. I think I saw, and Cyrus might have been there too, tumor necrosis factor alpha. The researchers adjusted for covariates, including sex, age, body mass index, BMI, in other words, exercise, smoking patterns, drinking behavior, and the presence of chronic illness. And the research found, ready, drumroll, the research found no direct link between depression and inflammation. But it has revealed insights into the effects of individual symptoms and lifestyle factors. For instance, reports this study, some specific depression symptoms appear to be related to increased inflammation, such as sleep problems. The relationship between depression and inflammation was strongly attenuated after adjusting for body mass index, for example, as obesity and smoking were also associated with higher inflammation. So according to the new research, depression is linked with inflammation only in people with very specific characteristics. Overall, according to the study, the relationship between depression, inflammation, and covariates is likely highly multivariate. I know that this technical ease is not the easiest to follow. I interpret this to mean the relationship between depression, inflammation, and the various conditions that somebody might have is very different depending upon which types of condition you may or may not have. So we don't have to talk about multivariates and multi-causal, et cetera. But it's interesting. And so if you find that maybe you or somebody you know or care about is dealing with depression, this would be something to look into because there may be some other issues that could be addressed, such as something other than inflammation that may have an effect for the positive. The conclusion here is they say the study's author comments on the findings in the context of the importance of the medical community and how it has been placing emphasis on biomarkers, saying there is a hype about finding biomarkers, traces of disorders that can be measured in the human body, such as in blood. Over the past 30 years, scientists have been looking for biomarkers for depression, hoping to answer the question, can you also measure depression by testing someone's blood, for example? Instead of conducting extensive diagnostic interviews, psychiatrists could then test someone's blood. No clinically useful biomarkers have been found so far, and one of the remaining hopes, inflammation, has largely been refuted as well. So there's that. 888-914-9149. Why don't we go to Carol, listening in Toms River, New Jersey. Good morning, Carol. Welcome.
Good morning. Listen, the reason I'm calling is I wanted to know, is the Blessed Mother was born in May, was she not?
Your voice cut out. The Blessed Mother was what?
The Blessed Mother. Was she born in May?
I don't know.
What month?
I don't know. I mean, the church.
I have a statue that I'm painting right now. It's over 100 years old in front of my house. And I was saying I was going to have a little party, but I think she was born in May. And that's what I'm calling to find out. And also, I was on the iPhone trying to find information. And it said that Joseph had a son from a previous marriage.
Well, let's pause there, okay? That idea that St. Joseph had sons, more than one, by the way, from a previous marriage before he married Mary, is not something that the church teaches. That actually was popularized with some literature that came out well after the time of the Gospels. So like the Proto-Evangelium of James, for example, that's one of the primary sources. So that came out probably around the beginning of the 3rd century, and the church rejects a lot of things that are found in that. But it has made its way into the popular mindset. So I think a lot of people just assume that when you see in Matthew 13, for example, where you've got men who are called the brothers of the Lord, those must be men from a prior marriage to St. Joseph. But the preponderance of the early church fathers, and I think really the view of the church in general, although it's not a dogmatic issue, is that St. Joseph was also a lifelong virgin, as was the Blessed Virgin Mary, and that he was not married to someone else before he married Mary. But I wanted to get back to your question about the Nativity of Mary, and her birthday is celebrated in the church on September 8th. And we don't have any evidence of when Mary was born from Scripture. There's no way to know from divine revelation. But there are references to her being born at that time in some of the early church literature. So that may or may not actually convey the truth of when she was born that had been handed down verbally, orally. But one thing we can say is that the Bible doesn't tell us specifically when she was born. So it's really a matter of conjecture, Carol.
Now, if she's, somebody had said she was buried in Turkey,
No.
I from the iPhone, it said she was born at the foot of Mount Olive.
We don't know. Yeah, these are pious notions that may or may not be true. I would tend to think that they're not true, but it's certainly not true that Mary was buried in Turkey. Rather, I think what you're thinking of is that there is a stone house on top of a very large hill, you know, the size of a small mountain. And tradition holds that it was there that Mary lived with St. John, to whom Jesus entrusted the Blessed Virgin Mary at the time of the crucifixion, and that for years they lived there in that house. Now, Blessed Anna Catherine Emmerich, she wrote about this in some of her, the description of some of the visions that she purported to have received, and some explorers, they decided to look to see if this house could be found, and they found it exactly where she said it would be. And she had been bedridden for decades and had not been to this place, so she would have no personal way of knowing. But the fact is, Mary, at the end of her earthly life, when she died, for lack of a better term, then at that point, or shortly after that point, God assumed her body and soul into heaven. This is the Assumption of Our Lady. So she wasn't buried anywhere. She might have lain in a place for a few hours, perhaps, before she was bodily assumed, but that would be the extent of it. There was no grave anywhere for the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Well, on the iPhone, it says she was born at the foot of Mount Olive.
There's no way to know that, though. That's what I'm saying, Carol. the Bible doesn't tell us anything about that. Now, if it's coming from an alleged seer, and I tend to think that Blessed Anna Catherine Emmerich is entirely legitimate, so I don't look askance at her, but even that would be in the level of private revelation. And the church does not say this is definitely true. So we really don't know where Our Lady was born. I hate to disappoint you.
Well, thank you very much.
I hate to disappoint you, but...
No, you're not disappointing me. I just wanted to clarify this because the iPhone has a different version.
The iPhone? What do you mean?
Well, I have an iPhone.
I see.
You know, a Verizon iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you call up, you can just ask Siri different questions.
Yeah, see, what's happening here is that you're getting information, but... the sources are not, they may not be, I'm trying to choose the right word here. I'm not suggesting necessarily that the source is wrong or that the source is not credible, but what you can take to the bank is that we don't know for sure. So anyone who says this is where Mary was buried, she wasn't buried, or this is where Mary was born, you have to realize that that is just some person's opinion, and it's not based upon any actual evidence from divine revelation. That'd be my suggestion. Well, Carol, thank you. Fascinating conversation. I'm glad we had a chance to talk about this. I hope you'll call me again. 888-914-9149. We are just about at the point where we have to take a break. I have a feeling the best thing to do would be to take that break now and then come right back to more phone calls with you. The number again, 888-914-9149. You can call now. We have lines open right now. And I'm going to share with you, when we return, some details about those saints who are known for levitating, you know, like floating in the air when they were praying to the Lord and they didn't even realize it. I'll tell you some of who they were and how it happened right after this.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values, and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Welcome back. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Saints who levitated. I mean, if you've studied any of the lives of the saints, and that, by the way, is a very good thing to do. Maybe you've never actually cracked open a book about the lives of the saints. You owe it to yourself to get to know some of these amazing friends of God. As a kid, when I was growing up, true confessions, I was mischievous. Yeah, I like to play basketball and baseball and all the fun stuff with my friends, but I got into trouble here and there. Not bad trouble. I mean, I never trouble with the law or anything like that. But, you know, not getting my chores done or not getting them done right, things of that nature. So my parents, it seems as I look back on it, that their punishment of choice was groundings. So I got grounded fairly frequently, may I say to you. And what my parents didn't realize was that I didn't mind being grounded, because when I was grounded, I was in my room and I had long, long hours of uninterrupted reading time, which was great with me because I love to read. And I've been a bookworm my whole life. So my dad said, well, you're grounded for the rest of the day. I would have to suppress a smile, because even though I would rather be outside playing with my cronies, I didn't mind being in my room, because if I was grounded in my room, I didn't have to do chores. I didn't have to do anything else. And I had a ton of books in my room. So that's what I would do, is I would read. And a lot of the things that I read, a fair amount of what I read when I was growing up were Lives of the Saints. My parents had a large library in the home. I mean, by large, I mean physically large, because the bookcases, my dad did some custom carpentry bookcases that were floor to ceiling. And in that living room in our house, we had a cathedral ceiling. So the bookcases went way up. And there were, it was also a large library insofar as there were, it seems to me, there must have been maybe a couple thousand books in that library. Because we were all readers. So lots and lots of books being purchased or given to us. And so that was a very nice resource to have in the home. And there were a lot of religious books, so Lives of the Saints as one example. So I spent a lot of time as a young man. And during this time of reading the Lives of the Saints, it really formed me. It made an impression upon me. And it really, in many ways, it taught me my Catholic faith through the lives of these people, these men, women, boys, and girls. And I always particularly found the lives of the martyrs very compelling. You know, kind of a fascination with somebody who's so willing to follow Jesus that even if it means following him all the way to Golgotha and to die as a martyr, I mean, to me, ask yourself this question. What are you willing to give up in this life? Are you willing to give up your morning cup of coffee? Some people aren't. Some days, I don't know that I am. But when you consider it against the possibility of would you be willing to give up even your life, and these people, these martyrs in the lives of the saints, they were. And often the way that they were martyred was particularly grisly, which I guess was part of the appeal to me when I was a kid. And I would be reading these stories and being amazed by the rigors of their execution, being burned to death or who knows why. It was just interesting to me. So for me, as I was reading the Lives of the Saints, I would run across these saints who levitated. And levitation is, interestingly, it's one of the hallmarks of somebody who is a profound mystic. So St. Teresa of Avila, she was known to meditate. St. Joseph of Cupertino was known to levitate. St. Francis of Assisi was known to levitate. And that doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that they could make things, like they could levitate things. Like, hey, take a look at that bowl of fruit on the table and then make it go up in the air. It doesn't mean that. What it means is that when they were praying, they would, without realizing it, typically they would not be aware of it because they'd be so deep in prayer, they would just simply float. And they would float 2, 3, 4, 5 feet off the air. It's told at St. Joseph of Cupertino that sometimes they had to tie ropes to him so he wouldn't float up to the ceiling because he would just float. He'd be in prayer and he'd be rising up above the ground. Now, there is a theological basis for this, and I want to get to the story here about saints who levitated, and I've got several of them here. This is from Catholic Exchange. I'll share that with you. But there is a little bit of a theological basis for this, and that is that, and we can see this even in our own physiology, is that the people who are less focused on worldly things, and let's get really specific here, let's say worldly things like food and drink, they tend to be skinnier. Now, it doesn't mean that people who are skinnier are holy, or it doesn't mean that people who are bigger are not holy. It doesn't mean that. But even in our own physiology, it's reflective of how the more attention you pay to things like food and like drink, the bigger you're going to be. That's just the way our biology works. So even people who might otherwise be plump, if they were saints, they often would be able to levitate. Now, the reason I say there's a theological connection here is that St. Thomas Aquinas, he talked about how the more virtuous somebody is and the more focused on the things of God they are and less focused on the things of the world, the less weighed down they are, the less encumbered they are, the less tied to this world they are. And in a theological sense, they rise. Now, this is not in time and space, but in a theological sense or in a spiritual sense, they sort of rise above the earthly things and they rise more easily toward God. So as one of the hallmarks of great sanctity, and this is not true of all the saints, not even necessarily of most of the saints, but it's certainly true of a good number of them, it was an outward sign to other people. It was for the benefit of other people who would see this and they would marvel at it. And in some cases, their lives would be changed as a result, and they would realize that they too wanted what this saint had, this relationship with God. So their rising into the air was redolent of their spiritual freedom. And their lightness of body was a way of talking, a way of reflecting, I guess you might say, the lightness of their soul, because their soul was not being dragged down by the cares and the worries and the enslavements of this life. So here are some examples. This is from Catholic Exchange. St. Francis of Assisi levitated, as I mentioned, and it goes through a series of other ones. St. Bonaventure, who was born in 1221, 5 years before St. Francis died, he entered the Franciscans and became the order's seventh leader. While mostly known as a philosopher, St. Bonaventure also wrote about his order's founder, including the claim that St. Francis was often found floating in the air during his spiritual ecstasies. Reports from later writers echoed and expanded on these claims, saying that St. Francis would soar to the treetops and sometimes into the sky, where he could barely be seen. Can you imagine? Could you imagine you're like in a backyard barbecue and your wife, who's super holy, she just starts like rising up above the lawn chair, and then she's like 10 feet in the sky. And then before you know it, you have to go in and get your binoculars to see her because she's way up, way, way up in the clouds. That's what they're talking about here. And there are eyewitness accounts of this happening. The difficulty is that in 1245, 19 years after he had died, a detailed investigation into St. Francis's life was made by the church. Authorities interviewed many people who knew him, and none of them mentioned levitation. So either St. Bonaventure had access to materials that have not survived, or the stories of levitation were an invention that Bonaventure heard of and repeated as a fact. But it seems that, knowing St. Bonaventure, that the latter is very unlikely. The latter is almost certainly not true, but it makes you wonder why some people didn't mention this. But I would think it would probably be because they didn't want someone to think they were crazy. You saw him what? Yeah, I saw him float. Ah, come on, I can't believe that. St. Teresa of Avila, she is known to have levitated on any number of occasions. Her levitations were witnessed repeatedly by many people. We also have her own accounts in her writings. She describes the experience in her autobiography. Although she preferred not to discuss such matters, she wrote the book under obedience to her superior. Here she describes how she resisted these raptures that sometimes led to levitation. She said, quote, "These effects are very striking. One of them is the manifestation of the Lord's mighty power, as we are unable to resist His Majesty's will, either in soul or in body, and are not our own masters. We realize that, however irksome this truth may be, there is one stronger than ourselves, and that these favors are bestowed by Him, and that we ourselves can do absolutely nothing. This imprints in us a great humility. Indeed, she says, I confess that in me it produced great fear, at first a terrible fear. One sees one's body being lifted up from the ground, and although the spirit draws it after itself, and if no resistance is offered, does so very gently, one does not lose consciousness. At least I myself have had sufficient consciousness to enable me to realize that I was being lifted up. The majesty of Him who can do this, God, is manifested in such a way that the hair stands on end, and there is produced a great fear of offending so great a God, but a fear overpowered by the deepest love, newly enkindled for one who, as we see, has so deep a love for so loathsome a worm," she's referring to herself there, "that he seems not to be satisfied by literally drawing the soul to himself, but will also have the body, mortal though it is, and befouled as is its clay by all the offenses it has committed." So she felt that this gift of levitation was something that she really didn't want, but she couldn't resist it. There are similar anecdotes told by nuns who saw St. Teresa of Avila spontaneously levitate. After the events, she would order them never to speak of it. But later, under obedience to higher authorities during the church's investigation into her life, they described the incidents. For her part, St. Teresa was greatly embarrassed by her levitations and prayed that they would stop. And by all accounts, they did decrease greatly in her later life. By the way, there's a lesson to be learned here as we proceed, and that is that you notice her humility. So not only was she renowned as a profound mystic, which she was, and she was a paragon of sanctity. She wasn't that way from the beginning, but she grew into that by God's grace. But you'll notice here that she was not prideful. And St. Teresa of Avila did not go around and say, "Hey, everybody, by the way, I can levitate, Okay, just FYI, you know, because you better stay out of my way because I might levitate. She was exactly the opposite. She didn't draw attention to herself. She didn't draw attention to that fact. She told people not to talk about it. And I would juxtapose that, just for the sake of it, with people who do go around saying that they're, you know, that they have the gift of this or the gift of that. Or they'll come and tell you, oh, the Holy Spirit is telling me something about you, a secret word of knowledge. Usually when somebody is announcing to other people that he or she is a prophet or a healer or a seer or something, that's usually a very good sign that they're not. Because the authentic saintly people like St. Teresa of Avila and many others, the ones who really did have these gifts, that's the opposite of what they did. There's a really clear consistency that growth in holiness also involves a growth in humility. And it's not really all that humble to go around presenting yourself as, well, by the way, I'm a healer. By the way, I'm a seer. By the way, I have this gift or that gift. That's, as I say, it's almost always an indication that that person does not, in fact, have this gift that he or she thinks she does. We have a little more time. Let's talk about St. Joseph of Cupertino. I mentioned him earlier. He might be one of the most famous levitating saints. He lived from 1603 to 1663. He had a difficult childhood. He probably, according to the author of this article, would have been diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder of some kind. He was apparently not intelligent and was given the nickname the open mouth because he so often stared into space with his mouth open. Meanwhile, perhaps due to his limitations and others' responses to them, he developed a bad temper. To make matters worse, when his father died, when Joseph was still a young kid, his mother may have been verbally and physically abusive toward him. He wanted to join the Franciscans, but due to his lack of education, they would not take him. He was then accepted by the Capuchins on a trial basis, but they sent him away after 8 months. His mother did not want him back home, so she asked her brother, a Franciscan monk, to take him as a servant at his monastery. Her brother agreed and assigned Joseph to care for livestock. Over time, Joseph's temper mellowed, and he started doing better with his work, well enough for the Franciscans to allow him to study to become a priest, and in fact, he was ordained in 1628. After his ordination, Joseph of Cupertino undertook many penances, including rigorous fasting, usually eating solid food only twice per week. Then he started going into spiritual ecstasies when he said Mass or he looked at devotional statues. During these ecstasies, he often levitated a few inches to a few feet off the ground. His levitations were so frequent that people started coming to see him for entertainment. During the investigation of his cause for sainthood, authorities corroborated at least 70 occasions when he levitated in the presence of witnesses. One notable example happened during a visit to Italy from the Spanish ambassador. The ambassador had visited Joseph in his monastic cell and was so impressed that he wanted to return with his wife. Joseph entered the church where the couple hoped to meet him, and upon seeing a statue of Mary elevated 10 feet into the air, he flew over the crowd to the statue. He flew over the crowd to the statue. He said some prayers, then he flew back to the door, and then he went home. The church later took depositions from a number of people who were there that day, and all their stories were consistent. There were many other instances that were investigated in a similar way, including one in front of Pope Urban VIII. It was customary to kiss the Pope's feet at that time as a sign of homage to the Holy Father. When Joseph did so, he rose into the air and was able to come back down only when his superior ordered him to do so. Pope Urban VIII said that if Joseph died during the Pope's lifetime, he would testify to the levitation that happened in his own presence. After a time, Joseph's levitations became a problem for the monastery. Some thought the episodes were demonic, and he was denounced for witchcraft and investigated by the Inquisition. They sent him to a monastery in Assisi for observation. He was ordered not to say public masses and to cease public appearances altogether, but his levitations continued in the monastery, and he was soon relegated to his cell and not even allowed to eat with the other friars. Could you imagine you're in the refectory, you're eating dinner, and one of the monks, five seats down from you, is, you know, like floating in the air. Who's that guy? Oh, that's Joseph. He does that all the time. That's what it must have been like. Eventually, the Inquisition determined that he was not practicing witchcraft and let him return to regular monastic life. He died in 1663 at the age of 60, and he was canonized in 1767 by Pope Clement the 13th. Do we have time for one more? Well, you should read this. We're going to get a link. Jim is going to get a link to this posted for us on the show Twitter feed, and that is at P Madrid Show. There are a few more instances here. Another one, St. Mary of Jesus Crucified. She, too, levitated, and it's documented amply by eyewitnesses. Some of the stories are really astonishing. And I guess that leads me back to the issue of the lives of the saints. I would strongly recommend, especially parents, get some of those books in your home. Leave them out where the kids are going to read them. And even if there are no pictures, the stories themselves will be amazing resources to help your children grow in their knowledge of the faith. I myself learned a lot about my Catholic faith by reading the lives of the saints. So give it a try. What have you got to lose, right? And if you come in one day and you see one of your kids levitating, you're going to know what's going on. You have a saint on your hands. I'll be right back with hour two right after this. Now!